Let's talk about resistance and revolution. First, it's essential to talk about the whole orientation and the whole practical importance of breaking out of the existing political confines, even in order to wage effective resistance, especially in the context of what's going on in the world today and the whole orientation and program of the dominant core of the ruling class to which I've referred earlier. One of the essential things that we have to grasp ourselves, obviously, but also struggle with other people over in a good way, is a very simple and basic truth. The Democrats and the Republicans are ruling class parties. That may sound like a simple statement, or it may sound like a dogmatic communist piece of rhetoric, but it's true, and it's an essential truth. When you hear these people talking, step back for a second and listen to the terms in which they are talking. They are talking about the interests of a system in which you, if you are someone who wants to see good things happening in the world, have no interest and should have nothing to do with. The terms in which they're, even before you're willing to reject the whole system, listen to the terms on which they're talking and see if those terms have anything to do with what you're concerned about. Now, here it is worth calling attention to and briefly elaborating on the following from the book Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? On why the superstructure must essentially conform to the economic base. There it says, quote, in addition to what has already been shown about elections, which clearly refutes the notion that laws are legislated by the representatives of all the people and indicates that instead they are legislated by representatives of the ruling class, the reality is that in any case, laws must reflect and serve the underlying economic relations and the interests of the class that is dominant in those relations. Otherwise, if the laws were in conflict with the fundamental property relations, the economic basis of society would be completely disrupted and society could not function. This is from Chapter 3, appropriately titled The Illusions of Democracy. Now, what's said there in what I just read from the Democracy book, Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That, is little understood, to wildly understate the matter, but of great importance to understand in order to grasp the reality, the actual dynamics of politics in a country like the U.S., and the relation of these politics to the underlying economic base. Let's go back to the point that was made earlier about the right to eat. Why is there no basic right to eat in a society like the one that prevails in the U.S., in a system like the one that prevails in the U.S.? And what would happen if there were somehow articulated and formulated into law such a right? I pointed this out before. Total chaos would ensue. People would show up, for example, at supermarkets, walk in, go to the various shelves, take a cart, put everything in the cart, and head for the door. And when the people came to accuse them of shoplifting, they say, shoplifting? What are you talking about? There's no such thing as shoplifting. I have a basic right to eat, and here's the stuff I'm going to eat right here. See you later. Well, obviously, that couldn't happen. Why? Because the people didn't really have a need to eat? No. Because the property relations that exist as a reflection of the more underlying production relations couldn't coexist with that kind of phenomenon in the superstructure. Couldn't exist where either by law or by social practice, people just had a right to go in and take whatever they needed. The whole economic system would, in fact, be completely disrupted, and society could not function if this became a big phenomenon in society. The capitalists would rightly say, who produce food and who relate to the production of food, that their ability to function would be completely undermined, that they couldn't make profit, that they couldn't keep producing food, and soon there would be no food, and then nobody could eat. So the laws and the superstructure in general, including the enforcement of the laws, has to, in a fundamental, not in a narrow, reductionist, linear, one-to-one sense, but in an overall sense, has to conform to the property relations, to the basic production relations, or else things will grind to a halt, will be erupt into chaos. Things will be completely disrupted. And it's not just on simple things, although very basic things like eating, but on any level. And you see this being played out. That's why I said earlier, listen to the debates of these people talking. The Republicans accuse the Democrats of, it's the battle cry for the 2006 interim elections, congressional elections. The Republicans, the Democrats, say the Republicans want to cut and run in Iraq. And what do the Democrats say? Well, some of us want to have an orderly withdrawal sometime in this decade. And some of us want to have a stepping up of the war. And some of us don't want to say anything about it. But no, not us. We're not cut and runners. And notice the very, to go from the more light to the more heavy, notice the point that was made very powerfully in Seymour Hersh's article about Iran. There is no pressure coming not to attack Iran, i.e. from the Democrats, for example, but there is lots of pressure. The only pressure there is coming from the right, from the hawks, whatever you want to call them, to attack. Why? Because the calculations that are being made by the political representatives are being made on the basis of what is in the interest of this system, what will keep this system going, what will happen to this system, for example, if we do pull out of Iraq precipitously, quote unquote. And in this argument, those who accuse the others of cutting and running have a lot going for them. Because what they say is essentially true. Now that they've gotten into Iraq, perhaps you could step back and say from the larger interests of the ruling class, there could be a debate about whether they needed to go into Iraq in the first place. But now that they're committed in there, to pull out would be a major defeat for U.S. It would, in fact, cause forces of opposition, including Islamic fundamentalists, to take heart from that and to be emboldened to attack not only in Iraq, but in other places, and to challenge the U.S. in other places. And the same is now developing in the debate around Iran. What happens if we do attack Iran? Here are a bunch of bad things. And what happens if we don't? These are even worse. Not because they're really worried that Iran's going to have a nuclear weapon next week, next month, or next year, but because openly defying the U.S. in particular and moving in that direction establishes Iran in a position which the U.S. cannot afford to allow it to be, even though it is not capable of standing up to the U.S. in terms of a nuclear confrontation or any other confrontation. And the debate is shaped by those interests which fundamentally find their point of origin and their fundamental roots in the underlying dynamics of the system. Not in a direct, in an economist sense of like the U.S., you know, has to control the oil in Iran in order to make the price at the gas pump go down. But because from a strategic calculation, this system, which operates in the way that I've been discussing, cannot continue to operate in that way if it allows these other forces to pose obstacles to it, and especially then there becomes a circular logic which takes hold with once you've committed yourself, you know, it's like any gangster. Once you've committed yourself to throw down to say, this is the way it's going to be, if you back away from that, it does encourage people to be emboldened to challenge you in other ways. And all this is rooted in the underlying dynamics of the capitalist system in its imperialist stage. It's not that if they don't go attack Iran within the next year, they won't be able to produce Nikes cheaply in Vietnam. It's not some, again, crude economist and reductionist one-to-one thing like that. But it's that the whole dynamics of their system will be undermined in certain ways, if they don't take certain decisive steps, or once having taken them, if they don't follow through with them and impose their will, bludgeon others into accepting their will, then the overall operation of the system, and ultimately, not one-to-one or immediately, but ultimately the operation of all the dynamics of capitalist accumulation will not be able to be maintained on the level that is necessary. And this is why they debate in the terms that they do. And the way the dynamics work, if you talk out of school, if you get out of line, if you debate or introduce terms that are different, you get ostracized, you get criticized, you get ridiculed, you get hounded and harassed, you get scandalized. All of a sudden, scandals get brought forth about you, and all these people have skeletons in their closet. And you get reminded not to talk in those terms. I remember, for example, there was a Republican candidate who was seeking to run for president in 1988. And at one point he withdrew from the race and he said, "The money's just not there." Now, what is the meaning of that statement? It wasn't a statement that, well, my message won't resonate, you know, with the rank and file of the Republican Party. It was that the people who would finance a campaign don't want the message that I'm putting out, or at least they don't want me to be the one to articulate it for whatever reasons. And I've used this example before, that elections in the U.S. are like a very complicated audition. Complicated in audition in the sense that what you're essentially doing is, you know, it's a little bit, you know, like the popular shows they have where people get on and perform. Secondarily, you're trying to get the approval of the audience, but primarily you're trying to get the approval of the panel of judges. And, you know, American Idol or whatever, you got to get the approval of the judges. Now, part of getting the approval of the judges is by showing that you can move the audience in a certain way, but ultimately it comes back to the judges. And it's the same thing in elections. The audition is to the panel of judges, to where the money is to finance the campaigns. But part of auditioning for them is to convince them that you can influence the quote-unquote electorate in a way that they want it influenced. That is the part of the way in which you audition, not for the public, quote-unquote, but for the panel, for the people who will or will not finance a campaign. And how does that panel decide whether your audition is any good or not? Or when do they bring out the Simon Cowell to tell you you stink and get the hell out of here? It's based on their calculation of their strategic interests and how what you're doing, A, directly will serve those interests, and B, will serve them, so to speak, indirectly by influencing the populace in the way they want it influenced. That's what makes the audition complicated. You're not just auditioning for them to see if they like the key that you sing in, but you're also auditioning in the sense of whether or not they think you can influence the audience, the electorate, if you will, the populace, whatever you want to call it, in the way they want to influence. Both things are part of the audition. But it's all on the terms of the dynamics of this system. And if you get outside of the dynamics of that system, if you start saying, for example, well, look, it's ridiculous that we spend so much on the military when people are so hungry in the world. We should cut the military budget in half and use that money to feed the people in the world. I was just listening to Bono the other day, and he convinced me. Well, you know, you can run that out, but you're not going to be a serious candidate for any significant elective office in the U.S., especially not president, saying that. Why? for all the reasons I was discussing earlier, because that does not conform to the underlying dynamics and to the superstructural expressions, politically and militarily and geostrategically, of those underlying dynamics. You're totally out of line with the way things actually work, to put it in simple terms, and you will get nowhere. Maybe you'll get, you know, an article in The Nation or something, but you will get nowhere in terms of actually getting close to exercising any power or, you know, any political influence on the direction of government and society in an overall sense. Because you're out of whack, you're out of line with what the actual dynamics are and how that expresses itself in terms of the political and geostrategic needs of the people who are the dominant class within those production relations and who control that system and who fashion and use elections to function, as is said in those two sentences, as political structures to reinforce that. They have found it up to this point to be convenient and actually a brilliant device, as they developed it, to do this in the form of elections. Serves their interests all the better, at least up to this point. But that is what is going on, and not something else. And that is why programs that may conform to what a lot of people, for example, you took a poll, the famous polls, in the Democratic Party, and you said up or down on what I just articulated about cutting the military budget, probably a majority of people would strongly be in favor. But it has nothing to do with what the Democratic Party will adopt. Why? That's a question people should be asked to seriously engage. Why that discrepancy? What does that flow out of? What does that reflect? What does that tell us? So, in sum on this particular point, the fundamental point here is that's brought out in the passage cited above from Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That? And in particular, the last sentence of that passage provides essential aspects of the understanding of how this system works the way it does and why it works and can only work in the way it does in fundamental terms. And the lack of this understanding continues to feed illusions of the possibility of reforming the system and of relying on people and organized forces, such as the Democratic Party, which are in fact the representatives not of the people, but of the ruling class of this system, and are the functionaries who protect the system against the interests of the masses of people and ultimately enforce its rule over them. And in this light, the following statement by Lenin stands out as all the more insightful and important and with great relevance for today. Lenin said, "People always were and always will be the foolish victims of deceit and self-defeat." Self-deceit, note well, deceit and self-deceit in politics, until they learn to discover the interests of some class or other behind all moral, religious, political, and social phrases, declarations, and promises. That's worth reading again. People always were and always will be the foolish victims of deceit and self-deceit in politics until they learn to discover the interests of some class or other behind all moral, religious, political, and social phrases, declarations, and promises. The supporters of reforms, he goes on, the supporters of reforms and improvements will always be fooled by the defenders of the old order until they realize that every old institution, however barbarous and rotten it may appear to be, is maintained by the forces of some ruling classes. As I said, extremely insightful in importance and with great relevance today. Now let's go on with that general background and framework and briefly review why the alignment within the ruling class is the way it is. In other words, another way to put this is back to the pyramid of power and the underlying material basis and dynamics of this. Now, one of the big reformist mythologies that's out there, and you can see this repeatedly in various analyses that are made by liberals and progressives, is often, you know, I've read a number of books by and articles and other pieces by these people, and they'll often do a lot of good exposure you know, of the right wing of the, what's objectively the certain section of the right wing of the ruling class, and of, you know, Christian fundamentalism in particular and its influence on the Republican Party and all this kind of stuff. And then they'll come to the end with their, and what their proposed solution is. And it's just, I'm sorry to say, pitiful in comparison even to what they've just laid out as what you're up against. And there's a very common thread that often runs through these things of saying, well, you see, the problem is that the right got itself organized and financed over a period of decades. And they set up these financial institutions, you know, Mellon Scaife and all these different foundations, the Cato Foundation and the, you know, all the rest of these right-wing foundations and book publishing firms. And they set up all these, you know, think tanks and so on. And they got all these talk show hosts on the radio. And they've been doing this for three decades. And that's why, you see, it's like the balance scale. That's why all the weight has gone, gone over here to the right. So what we have to do is dig in for the long haul and build up our financial institutions, our spokespeople. Get them into the media, or get our publishing houses, build up our various infrastructures and so on and so forth. Then we'll be able to counteract them. No, you won't. Not in that way, because that's not the essential reason why this is the preponderant and prevailing and predominant view and influence within the ruling class. Yes, all those, once again, all those phenomena are real. Over decades, these forces have gotten themselves organized. They have, you know, made big forays into talk radio and into the media in general and into other key institutions. They have gotten these right-wing foundations to fund a lot of things. They have set up book publishing firms. They have built up other infrastructure. But that is an expression, once again, of something much more fundamental. It's an expression of what has been going on in the world, which I spoke to earlier. And the drive within a section of the ruling class to completely change the social compact or the glue which holds things together on the one hand, and on the other hand, the lack of ability on the part of other sections of the ruling class, for convenience and popular expression, let's say, grouped around the Democratic Party, their total lack of ability to come up with a coherent alternative strategy. Holding on to the New Deal and Great Society programs is not a strategy that can be a winning program within the ruling class at this time. There are international factors, there are dynamics within the U.S. in relation to and in the context of those international factors which favor this other program. And that's why they get a lot of funding from the ruling class. And that's why they're able to do all the things that people notice, speaking more to the surface phenomena, which I was speaking to, setting up foundations, financing things, setting up infrastructure, and so on. And yes, there's, you know, George Soros, and he spent wasted $27.5 million on Move Nowhere. And, you know, it's not going to get anywhere, because as much money as he has and as much money as he's willing to spend, he cannot come up with, or he has not come up with, a program that provides a coherent opposition to this driving force of this other section of the ruling class. And the more this other section of the ruling class carries ahead its program, it's like what I said about Iraq, the more it sets the terms and narrows the basis for any kind of ruling class opposition. Now, I wouldn't sit here and say no other section of the ruling class could conceivably come up with an alternative program under a different or even some of the same sets of conditions. But it's not easy for them to do so. And so far, they have not been able to do so. And this is why everybody, from Bill Maher to everybody else, you know, or Arianna Huffington, everybody talks about the Democrats have no spine. Well, it's not really an anatomical problem of lack of spine. They don't have and have not been able to develop a coherent program which poses an alternative to this. Because of the changes, because of how the Cold War was resolved, because of how things were set loose on that basis, because of the heightened globalization, because of the underlying material basis for what was the Democratic Party program for administering capitalism, as embodied in things like a New Deal and the Great Society programs, doesn't have the same basis it had in the past. This is what is fundamentally driving and setting the terms here, and not that one side got better organized while we were sleeping or underestimating the danger. Yes, you were sleeping and underestimating the danger, but that's not the essence of what's going on here. It's rooted in something much deeper, you know, and more determining dynamics that are driving this forward and setting the stage within which the debate within the ruling class goes on. And that's what it is, once again, folks. It's a debate within the ruling class whose terms are set by these underlying dynamics and in turn are set by the aggressive and cohesive assertion of a program by a section of the ruling class which has come to predominate, namely, at this point, those grouped around Bush. So the Democratic Party, yes, in one sense you could say on a superficial level, it lacks spine, but the reason it lacks spine is because it is on the one hand a ruling class party, and on the other hand it can't come up with a program for the ruling class that's coherent and meets the needs and corresponds to the dynamics and what that sets in motion in the context of what has gone on and what is going on in the world today. And then there's the additional dimension spoken to in the pyramid of power. If you look at this again, over here on the right, this section of the ruling class has cultivated and developed and is bringing forward a social base. And while there are contradictions there, and that social base could get, you know, get a little bit out of their control and could begin to set terms even that they may not want set, you know, political operatives like Karl Rove or whatever, mainly they are perfectly happy to mobilize that social base on the terms that things are now going. Whereas on the other side, you had this the Democratic Party convention, for example, in 2004, and everybody, even the mainstream commentators, couldn't fail to notice this. There was this just tremendous disconnect, as they say, between what was going on the stage, John Kerry reporting for duty, and, you know, what even the rank and file, you know, functionaries of the Democratic Party wanted, for example, in relation to the Iraq War, was very acute. And they don't even want to mobilize those people to do anything beyond a very limited framework, let alone the masses of people that spontaneously tend to look to the Democratic Party. The masses of oppressed people and people really alienated in the society, the last thing they want to do is bring those people out mobilized in massive resistance against this other program. Partly because they have nothing they want to mobilize them, that they can coherently mobilize them around. Partly because they're afraid of, in a very basic sense, they're afraid of those masses. And they're also afraid of what would get set loose, even in terms of the reaction of the other section of the ruling class, if they were to do this. So when you put all those elements together, you can see, it's like having an x-ray machine, and you can see, it doesn't just tell you that the Democrats have no spine, but this x-ray machine can tell you why they have no spine. So these are the basic dynamics of what's going on inside, among the powers that be, to put it that way. And that is, again, important to emphasize. This is what we're talking about. It's a debate among representatives of the ruling class over what is the best way in a strategic sense. Sometimes it gets very narrow, but ultimately it's over the strategic terms of what is the best way to pursue the interests of this system and of the ruling class that presides over this system. Now, if anybody wants to say that's just a bunch of rhetoric and commie dogma, then let's get down to the reality and examine, and we better be good at this. You know, it's like I say, ideologically, we should want to wage, struggle ideologically, but metaphorically, we shouldn't fire ideological blanks. If people want to get down and discuss and debate this with us, which we should encourage and struggle for them to do, we better have the substance to make the case, and it can be made, and we should and can have the substance, but we better have it. You can't just spiel out rhetoric with no substance. You can't just say these are representatives of the ruling class. You have to show how that's so, not only sort of in the populist sense of showing where their money comes, but you have to be able to illustrate in a living way what the actual dynamics are, why they make the choices they do, why they present the alternatives and lack of alternatives that they do, and what that's all rooted in. So we have work to do. I'm sketching this out here and speaking to the basic contours of it, but we have work to do in a very urgent way. It's not that we can spend months and years in research. We have work to do. We have to be aggressively bringing this out to people at the same time as we're digging down to bring out more concretely the substance that fleshes out this basic analysis. And it's there because this is the reality, and it's demonstrated every day in life, including, as I said, just sitting down and listening to the terms on which they debate. Those are not the terms of people who are trying to see a more equitable world, if you will. They are not the terms of people who can't understand why, in a world where there's so much wealth on the one hand, so many people are suffering in terms of basic needs on the other hand. Those are not the terms. I'm not going to say no bourgeois politician, no ruling class politician ever throws out some rhetoric like that. But when you get down to the substantial terms on which they argue and debate, those are not the terms. Why? It has to do with everything I've been speaking to. So next I want to move on and talk a little more on the question of the coming civil war and repolarization for revolution. Now first, as a way of getting into this, it's important to focus for a minute on the fundamental orientation toward revolution. That is the orientation of hastening while awaiting the development of a revolutionary situation. This orientation is crucial in terms of being able to not be a slave to what the objective conditions are at any given time and not, you know, losing your basic revolutionary orientation while working in conditions where a revolutionary situation has not yet emerged. Now, as we know, Mao developed this, brought forward this formulation, hastening while waiting, in the context of the war against Japan, which in turn was in the larger context of World War II. He was saying that they were, you know, basically have to remain on the strategic defensive in that war against Japanese occupation until there were a major change in the overall situation occurred. And he defined this in terms of not just awaiting a change, but hastening while awaiting. In that case, which is qualitatively different than the situation we're in, it was a matter of actually waging war to hasten and help ripen the development of an actual qualitative change in the situation. By waging a war of resistance against the Japanese, they tied down and wore down a lot of Japanese forces. And as things occurred on the broader international tapestry, in particular as the Soviet Union, after Stalingrad, began to roll back the forces of Nazi Germany, of German imperialism, then the whole balance in the world began to shift. And by the end of World War II, they were able to be in a much strengthened position, and Japan was forced out of China, partly through their efforts and partly through the larger international struggle or international war. So in that case, it was literally a matter of hastening while awaiting through waging a war of resistance. But one does not have to be at war, as we are not and cannot be at this stage, in order to hasten while awaiting the development of a revolutionary situation. And this orientation is extremely important because if you lose it, then you're going to, you know, inevitably fall into reformism, especially in a country like this, up against such a powerful ruling class with all the difficult conditions that, you know, that exist and with the difficulties that have to be worked through to actually get to a revolutionary situation and to be able to seize on it. All the factors that I was talking about earlier, including some of the things that others have criticized in terms of as I said at the very beginning, you know, the fat, you know, the soft fat middle of U.S. society. Let's face it, it's there, it's real. Have to deal with it. You know, it's there and it's real. You know, and other phenomena that are part of, you know, the whole parasitism of imperialism, and are also part of the particular way in which this society has developed in the context of the world situation in recent years, including the whole deindustrialization of, you know, a large part of the urban seen in the U.S. and the way in which people have been, thrown to the side, and written out of the formal economy, and all the various things that have gone along, these are all real problems. Every revolution encounters real problems. Sooner or later, all along the way in one sense, but sooner or later in a very acute and concentrated way. There's no revolution that just goes like that. Every revolution encounters real problems, and acutely and in a concentrated way encounters them at various stages. But we've got a shitload of them from the beginning. And there's no point in trying to downplay that or ignore it. For one thing, if we do, people will know that we're not serious. And even more fundamentally, we won't be serious. We won't be scientific. We won't actually be dealing with what we're up against. And in the face of all that, if you simply await, and carry out struggles for concessions and reforms, and aren't hastening at every point to the maximum degree possible developments toward a revolutionary situation, you will, whether you want to or not, and whether you intend to or not, you will give up on revolution. There is a constant pull, especially in a society like this and in this country and the role it plays in the world, there's a constant pull away from that. And there are constant pulls in other directions in the face of that to try to find gimmicks or to take roads that don't actually lead to revolution. But the greater danger is just to be worn down by all these various factors and by the strength of everything you're up against, and to lose your bearings and give up your revolutionary orientation. It's like that Lenny Wolf article. You end up signing a contract for a sellout that you never intended to. And there's no magic inoculation against that. There's no, vaccine you can take politically and ideologically that prevents that from happening. But if you maintain the tenseness and the orientation of hastening and moving things as far as you can toward revolution, even while you have to await a qualitative change in the objective situation before a revolutionary situation can emerge, then you have a fighting chance of remaining on the revolutionary road while also contributing everything you can to the development, in political terms, to the development of the world revolution, and in ideological terms. So hastening while awaiting has a lot to do with the correct understanding of the relation between objective and subjective factors. And I've spoken to this before, but I just want to briefly touch on it here. The objective conditions at any given time set the stage for what you can do. If you don't have an objective situation out of which you can develop a revolutionary struggle for power, simply trying to artificially create that struggle or create those conditions will not work and will lead to bad, even disastrous results. So that's something that's very important to be aware of, and we should guard against the danger to be fall into subjectivity and think that just by will we can create a revolutionary situation or make a revolution. On the other hand, the much, much greater danger, especially in a country like this, is bowing down to the objective conditions at any given time, is having a mechanical understanding of how to relate to the objective conditions, having a determinist and ultimately a slavish orientation toward objective conditions. You know, that whatever the objective situation is at any given time is uniform, static, unchanging and without contradiction. There's nothing basically you can work on. All you're doing is waiting for something to happen somehow, somewhere in the world, or maybe in some other world. You can even fall into that. Some supernatural thing or something that's going to change all this magically, even if you don't call it that. It can amount to that. So it's very important to have an active and dynamic understanding of an approach to objective condition. Objective conditions are contradictions. Objective conditions are not static, uniform, undifferentiated wholes. They are contradictions. Correctly understanding that and then proceeding to correctly analyze the contradictions You can go to work on the objective conditions even while they are more determining the context for things than what you are doing at any given time. You can significantly influence those objective conditions and change them through your conscious and dynamic role by analyzing correctly the contradictions within them. Right now, U.S. imperialism is very powerful. That's an objective factor we have to deal with, but it's not just all-powerful end of discussion. It's very powerful, but also running into real problems in the world. And on the brink of diving into greater, turmoil and potentially greater problems on a whole other scale. For example, if it goes ahead and attacks Iran. Who would have expected that what happened around Katrina would have happened? Now, that's not to wait, again, for some magical, supernatural thing, but it shows that all this is full of contradiction. That is, again, accident and necessity. In a certain sense, it was an accident that hurricane hit that city in that way at that time. On the other hand, there were real reasons why it did. Meteorologists and others could analyze why it happened. There were also real reasons why the levees didn't hold. People could analyze that. But nobody could have precisely predicted what the response of the government would have been, and what the dimension of the suffering would have been, what the government did and didn't do gave rise to certain outrage on a broad scale in society. You have to always be tense for the emergence of things which are not immediately apparent, even on the horizon, but which flow out of the fundamental contradictory nature of reality in general and of the system in particular, and more specifically of the actual situation that is prevailing at a given time. And it all has to be guided by a strategic orientation of hastening things toward the emergence of a revolutionary situation and contributing whatever you can to accelerate that motion, even while you are mainly not setting the terms. You have to have a dialectical and not a mechanical, vulgar, crude, materialist understanding and approach to this. You can't overstep the objective conditions, but you can affect them and even in important ways transform them. I mean, you take a very acute example. What happens with a major effort like World Can't Wait will greatly affect the objective conditions, one way or another. It won't in and of itself bring about a revolutionary situation. That isn't even the political objective at this time. But it may bring into being, if it develops in a certain way, all kinds of things, some of which are unforeseen. And you have to have the right tenseness, but underlying that, the right methodological, scientific approach and understanding, grounded in materialism and dialectics. Life is made up of matter in motion. Matter in motion is full of and moves through contradiction. Everything is the motion of matter. And the motion of matter resides in and proceeds through contradiction. What are the contradictions? How are they moving? How are they interrelating? These are the things we have to be constantly analyzing in order to recognize and to seize the maximum amount of initiative at any given time to transform the objective conditions, to hasten while awaiting. And the heart of revisionism in the whole history of the communist movement, or one of the main expressions of revisionism, of reformism in the guise of communism, to put it another way, is to have a determinist, a slavish attitude toward objective conditions, to only see the way in which, in broad terms, they set the stage for things, and not see the way in which you can affect that, even in significant ways, and even while and even before you have the full development of a revolutionary situation, and in order to advance toward the development of that situation. So these are crucial points, not just of philosophy in a general sense, although they are important in that realm, but they also have bearing on your whole strategic orientation and approach to everything. To everything that is required and everything we have to be about in order to change the world radically in the way it needs to be changed. And also in here comes once again the relationship between the particular and the universal. Some of these points are worth going over again and again and again because they have everything to do with whether we're actually going to be able to wield a scientific approach to reality in order to actually change the world, which is ultimately the point, without being narrow about it. The world cries out for radical change, and the point of grasping the correct outlook and methodology is ultimately and fundamentally to be able to change that world without being narrow about that and reducing it to the most, you know, immediate and particular aspect of, you know, what amounts to reforming the system. Mao said, what is particular in one context is universal in another, and vice versa. Okay. But what does it mean? Well, I've spoken to this before, and, you know, and what's the importance of it? Let's talk about that. Again, reality doesn't exist as an undifferentiated blob. Systems are full of contradiction and are moved by contradiction. Situations are that way. All of reality is that way. Well, what's the importance of this and how do we understand it? Well, I've used the example before. I've used the example of a war before. If you take the war situation as a whole, then that's the universal. And any particular campaign, even a major one within that war, is the particular. But then you can take that campaign, you know, a military campaign to capture a certain city, for example, or to drive the enemy out of a certain territory. If you take that as unto itself, that campaign is the universal, and any battle waged as part of that strategy is the particular. Then you can go down to another level. If you take a particular battle within that strategy for sieging that city or that region, that battle can be viewed as the universal. And then particular tactics within that battle, or what particular units of the armed forces would do, would be tactics within that strategy, would be particulars within that universal. Or take a meeting. If you have a meeting overall, that meeting is the universal. Any particular discussion within that meeting is a particular within that universal. But then, if you take that discussion, what somebody said in that discussion is a particular, right or wrong. And then you could keep going like that. And you can break all of reality down this way because all of reality consists of particular forms of matter and motion, particular aspects of reality. A city can be universal. What's happening in the city of Los Angeles? Well, many things. There are particulars. What's happening, you know, in the L.A. area? Well, what's happening in Westwood is different than what's happening in Watts. They're both particulars within that whole area of L.A. Well, what's happening in Westwood? Lots of different things, each of which is a particular within that universal of Westwood. What's happening in Watts? Lots of different things. Including some revolutionary things. So those are particulars within the universal of Watts, and so on and so forth. So the importance of this is, on the one hand, you have to pay particular attention to different aspects of reality and to what you're doing to change those particular aspects of reality, but you have to not lose the larger context in which that is taking place. And there are different levels of that larger context. That's the point of what's particular in one context is universal in another. You have to be able to correctly understand the interconnection of things and how what you're doing in one corner of things relates to the larger strategic picture, and how it can influence things. Sometimes what's happening in a very particular part of reality or of a situation can have a decisive effect on the development of things in a much larger context. For example, to go back to Katrina, had our party been in the position that it should have been in and needs to work to get into very urgently, where it could have significantly influenced the political terrain in relation to Katrina, by paying attention to that particular, we might have been able to change the country and even have, you know, reverberations in the world as a whole in a very significant way. If we had had the foundation to be able to mobilize and lead masses to resist what was happening to them right on the spot in that situation, which we have to get in the position to do, and we can't keep having situations develop where we're not in a position to do that. That affecting that particular thing would have had a very significant impact on the situation of the country, and as I said, with implications and reverberations more broadly in the world. So it's important both to understand the particular in any situation, but also how it relates to larger things, and to be able to determine which thing, by concentrating on it, could have a decisive impact on the larger situation, maybe even the situation as a whole. And you have to do that while keeping in mind and being guided in a fundamental sense by your strategic orientation and not getting lost in particulars. But on the other hand, not failing to recognize when certain particulars become concentrated expressions of contradictions in society and the world, and by affecting them, you can affect the larger strategic picture, as in the example of Katrina that I just cited. Now, another dimension to the particular and the universal and the importance of this is the relationship between particular countries and the international situation. Again, the world as a whole and the international situation as a reflection of that is not one undifferentiated blob. It's made up of contradiction and struggle and the motion as well as the struggle of those contradictions. And while overall the revolutionary movement may be set back in the world, there may be particular places where it's advancing. And what happens in those particular places may have bearing on the whole situation in the world and the overall revolutionary struggle in the world. And while looking at a particular country, there may not be a revolutionary situation. In another country in the world, there may be. And both of them exist in the larger international context, and both of them influence that international context in various ways. And what is internal for us, quote unquote, is external for other people. On one level, what goes on in this country is, quote unquote, external to people in India, shall we say, just to take an example somewhat arbitrarily. But on another level, they're both particulars within the larger situation of the world as a whole, within that larger universal. So understanding this is both important in terms of internationalism, but also important in terms of correctly handling the relationship between the struggle in different countries or different parts of even of a particular country, while not losing but being guided by this larger strategic sense of what this is all part of. What is the larger universal this is all part of? The larger universal for us is the struggle for communism. And the struggle, for example, to seize power in a particular country in that context is a particular, a damn important particular, but it's a particular. But in another context, that struggle to seize power can be the universal. And then all the working through the contradictions to achieve that seizure of power in a particular country in the context of the larger international situation, all those are particulars. So this is not just some sort of mental gymnastics, you know, or some sort of, you know, mental game that you can play. to keep yourself from being frustrated or whatever, or to heighten your frustration. This is all, you know, very important in terms of really grasping the living dynamics of this and being able to handle it correctly on all the different levels in which you have to actually work to affect the motion of reality in a certain direction, in an overall way. Now, with that as a background, I want to talk a little bit more about thank God for the Christian fascists. This is obviously meant to be a deliberately ironic comment on a couple of levels. But it's also a very serious point. And it ties in with the question of hastening while awaiting. One of the really acute problems you face, especially in a country like this, is the fact that a revolutionary situation comes along very rarely and only under, you know, a certain infrequently posed set of contradictions in the way in which they come together. And, you know, this is why Lenin talked about how in situations like that, decades can be concentrated in days. And that's the opposite of the fact that sometimes, you know, decades go on and not that much seems to be happening. But in fact, once again, we have to be working to hasten while awaiting all during that time, however long that time is. But one of the things that you have to be doing constantly, particularly in this type of country and more particularly in the U.S., is searching out the ways in which things could come together in such a way that the possibility of revolution becomes heightened and even becomes acutely posed. We have to face the reality, which is not just something that applies to the U.S., but to our movement and our historical experience as a whole, that up to this point, the successful proletarian revolutions and even successful national liberation struggles, which had more or less bourgeois leadership, like Vietnam, for example, occurred in the context of or were very much and even qualitatively influenced by World War. If you look at the Russian Revolution, that resulted because the involvement of Russia in the First World War and the insistence by the British and French and the Americans that Russia remain in the war and continue to prosecute it even after it brought tremendous suffering and wide-scale death to the people and the soldiers of Russia, brought things to the boiling point, so to speak. And even within the army of the Tsarist government and then the bourgeois republic and the Kerensky government after that, there was widespread discontent and a desire not to continue in the war and an inclination to revolt in the face of being forced to continue with the war even after the overthrow of the Tsar. And this is what heightened all the contradictions to such a point that revolution became possible, although we should realize, here's where the objective and subjective factors come together. Had it not been for Lenin applying the scientific method in the way he did, the possibility of that revolution would not have been recognized. And we wouldn't be debating decades later whether they should have made revolution or not and whether it led to horrors or to great things. Now, that's not to make a principle out of that and say that only one person can or should recognize that. But the point that is essential here is that it required a subjective element, the conscious element recognizing this objective development and working on it to ripen it fully to the most favorable revolutionary situation in a very telescope period of a few months in 1917 through a lot of tactical maneuvering. but essentially and fundamentally on the basis of recognizing and then working, recognizing the ripening and then further working to further the ripening of that revolutionary situation. And similarly for the Chinese Revolution in a different way and for Vietnam, these actually, if you will, sort of the fulcrum of those revolutions and the things that enabled them to get over the hump in a certain way was World War II. Now, in the case of Vietnam, there was several decades of fighting after that. But what enabled, to put it that way, what enabled the forces of Vietnamese resistance, in which the communists were at the core, even though their ideology was not fully communist, what enabled them to get to the core of that was what happened through World War II. A vacuum, quote-unquote, was created among the imperialists in relation to Indochina. As a result of World War II, the French were driven out, the Japanese who had occupied were defeated. Were the French going to come back? What were the Americans going to do? And in that context, the Viet Minh, led by Ho Chi Minh, were able to build a movement of resistance, seize a part of the territory, and even though they were driven into the countryside, they were able to wage a war against the French and then to follow that up with a war against the U.S. So the pivot and fulcrum, so to speak, of revolutions that had succeeded, in particular the Russian and the Chinese revolutions, were the First and then the Second World War. Now, what do you do if you're a revolutionary in the absence of world war? Wish for a world war so you could have a revolution? No. But what you do in general, and in specifically in the absence of a major, what Lenin called an event that acted as a stage manager, as he put it, for the revolution in Russia, what you do in the absence of that is to continue to be tense to and search out the ways in which the contradictions might come together in such a way that an opening can be wrenched for revolution out of all the swirl of that. Not that it's going to fall into your lap, but how it might be wrenched out of all the swirl and motion of those contradictions. So that's the general point. Methodological point, so to speak, but what about the specific point of thank God for the Christian fascists? How do they figure into this? Well, it goes back to a point I was speaking to earlier, that the Christian fascist program and drive, which they are seriously dedicated to and determined about, is not simply to reverse the verdicts that came out of the 60s, not simply to reverse Roe versus Wade, although that's one important plank or dimension to it, not even simply to reverse what happened through the Civil War, but to basically go back to the founding of the country and forge a different social compact and basis on which the country will be run than what actually happened through the founding of the country. In other words, to put it in simple terms, in place of a secular government, in essence, they want to insist upon a theocratic government. Now, I don't have time to go into the whole history of this, but this is important to understand, not because we want to fall into looking at things from the point of view of the bourgeoisie, quite the contrary, but from the standpoint of the proletariat and has scientific understanding of reality. It's very important to grasp some of the essential things that are at issue and being intensely contested here. One of the things about the founding of the country was that there was a big debate about whether there should be religious tests for people to hold office, and in general whether the religion should be written into the Constitution or kept out of the Constitution. And it was clear that had they so desired, the founders of the U.S. could have written a constitution, could have written religion into the Constitution. That was an option that was before them, and they could have won popular support for doing it. But a lot of them were, you know, influenced by the Enlightenment, and while many were religious themselves, although not necessarily in the conventional sense or traditional sense, And while the population was deeply religious, they considered it one of their big achievements to actually found a government in which there was separation of church and state, and in which religion would, contrary to Roy Moore and others, would not be the foundation for law and for the Constitution. Now, a number of studies of this had made the interesting point. I can't go on too long on this, but it is important to understand some of the actual dynamics and contradictions. Some of these studies have made the point that for a long time, the religious fundamentalists in the U.S. actually viciously and vehemently attacked the Constitution and the whole founding of the country because it was secular. And at various points in the history of the U.S., including at the time of and right after the Civil War, there were efforts to actually amend the Constitution to make it more, less secular and more theocratic, to actually write religion into the Constitution, and those were rejected and defeated. So for a long time, for much of the history of the U.S., the theocratic religious fundamentalist forces bitterly attacked the U.S. Constitution because it wasn't theocratic, because it was secular. And at different people, Susan Jacoby and others, I believe, have pointed out, after a certain point in the period we're in now, they have rewritten history. They've reversed course and rewritten history to say that the country was originally founded on Christian principles, and now all these secular humanists and all these other forces of the Antichrist are trying to take away the historical Christian foundation of this country. You know, and it's not just Roy Moore, it's also Antonin Scalia and so on who are saying that, you know, the word of God is the basis for law in this country. Well, that's not true. Historically, it's not a fact. And despite what certain relativism may say, facts matter. Reality matters. And it's not historically true. But now they've decided that it's more to their advantage to act as if this has been lately stolen from them and from the righteous country than to acknowledge that, in fact, the country got off on the wrong foot to begin with. But that is, in fact, what they're aiming for, is to go back and to set right what was on the wrong foot from their point of view from the beginning, in essence. And this is a very significant thing. It's sort of a, you know, to use the French phrase, a profession de foi, you know, it's sort of an article of faith, ironically, for many people in this country that there is a separation of church and state. That's kind of a, you know, almost an oxymoron, or anyway an ironic statement, but it's an article of faith that there's a separation of church and state for many people. You know, and you saw in the aftermath of the 2000 election, people sending around, it wasn't us, other people sending around these maps, Jesus Land on the one hand, and, you know, all this. This reflected, you know, a certain grasp of an important aspect of reality. Not fully scientifically in any sense, but nevertheless, it's a grasp of an important aspect of reality. And that is what these forces are aiming for, in essence, Jesus Land. And, you know, you can put it in terms of faith-based versus reality-based, or you can put it in terms of the importance of separation of churches and state versus separation of church and state is an abomination. But the fact is that this is a great divide. It has to do not just with sort of contemporary beliefs, but with foundational principles of the country as a whole, which have been regarded among sort of secular forces as one of the great achievements of American society and the American Revolution, the separation of church and state, which wasn't a new thing in the world at that time. So this move, which is a determined drive by powerful forces, not some fly-by-night incidental thing that, you know, is just being used for political convenience, calls into question very fundamental things for broad sections of people and poses very sharply the basic question of what kind of country it's going to be in a very foundational sense. Now, as with the situation in general, the polarization around this is not very good right now. It's not like, thank God for the Christian fascists, they're going to hand us the revolution. No. But what it is saying is, if you're thinking in terms of Lenin's metaphor of the stage manager, if you're thinking in terms of what might pose and throw up acutely contradictions in such a way that the whole question of the nature and direction of the society overall is in the balance, but not just in the balance in a passive sense, is up for grabs and being actively struggled over, and if you think about what it is that communists, from our perspective and in terms of the kind of society that we understand things need to go to, how it is we might influence and affect the development of these contradictions, which touch on such foundational things, then you could begin to envision how, in the context of the larger contradictions, not just in the U.S. but in the world, in the context of this whole grand strategy and the active offensive pursuit of that I spoke to earlier, in the context of all that, how this particular posing of the question of what kind of society is it going to be, in very fundamental and foundational terms, could be wrenched into something very different about what kind of society it's going to be. Could be part of a whole different synthesis that's brought forward and struggled for in that context. And it's not to say that this is going to guarantee the emergence of a revolutionary situation or somehow the victory of revolution if such a situation emerges, but it's trying to look at scientifically what are these dynamics that are not just superficial dynamics. They are occurring in the context of all the things I was talking about earlier. They're not just superstructural things hanging in the air by themselves. They are related to all these underlying contradictions and dynamics in the economic base, understood in a living and dynamic sense and understanding internationally as well. But within that context, and if a certain mix came together, and if a certain synthesis were fought for in the context of that whole cauldron boiling up, then a revolutionary situation might be brought into being and a revolution might be wrenched out of it. But that will not happen by relying on spontaneity. It will not happen by tailing bourgeois democratic forces and outlooks. It will not happen by sitting back and saying, oh, people will never stand for doing away with the separation of church and state, so all we have to do is wait until they're ready to fight and then we can... No. We have to be working on all these contradictions, including this particular acutely posed one, and moving to take them in a different direction, in a radically different direction, to wrench them into a whole different dynamic. But the point of identifying this is to see the way in which this, in the context of a certain mix that could come together out of all the contradictions that I've been speaking to and others that I haven't been able to speak to or just touched on, could sharpen things up in that kind of way. And if we've been consistently working on this in a certain way, it might be possible to actually mobilize masses of people in their millions and ultimately tens of millions to fight for something different than either a theocracy or a bourgeois democratic republic with separation of church and state. So the point of thank God for the Christian fascists is that they are contributing an element, a foundational element to the mix, to the contradictions, that could cause things to erupt in a certain way in the context of larger dynamics and in the context where we are identifying, first of all, and working correctly on all this. So that's kind of a brief discussion of what is meant by and what is the importance of thank God for the Christian fascists, which is not said in any kind of flippant way or facile sense or superficial sense, but it's speaking to some fundamental and driving contradictions. I want to move on and talk briefly about what is a concentrated focus of struggle now, one of the main concentrations of struggle now, which is driving out the Bush regime. One of the things I think we have to make very clear to people in the context of what's going on, in particular these elections that are taking place, whether we raise it as a formal slogan or not, what we have to make very clear to people is that even if the Democrats win through the 06 elections, we will not. And the essence of this, whether formulated exactly in those specific terms or in some other, the essence of this is crucial to grasp and to struggle to win other people to grasp. And it goes back to the point, all the points I was making in relation to the basic understanding that the Democrats, as much as the Republicans, are a ruling class political party. And what that means in fundamental terms and in the context of what's going on in the world today. I mean, look at the reality. Go down the list. Let's just do a quick survey here. Iraq, Iran, the Patriot Act, the Pledge of Allegiance. You remember that? Where were the Democrats when the court out in California made a ruling that under God should be taken out of the Pledge of Allegiance because it violated separation of church and state? They were out with the Republicans in front of the Capitol building reciting the Pledge of Allegiance with emphasis on under God. That's where the Democrats were. So, you know, so much for their principled and firm stand in defense of separation of church and state. Where are they on the Flag Amendment, so-called desecration? Dianne Feinstein just wrote an article defending the passage of this amendment. Where are they on academic freedom, critical thinking, and dissent? Where are they out in front defending and beating back the attacks on this? Or are they either silent or joining in the attacks? In the case, for example, of Ward Churchill and others. What have they done, and where has their stand been? What about abortion and birth control? What about the defense of traditional marriage and, among other things, its anti-gay stance? What about taking on or not taking on the Republic fascists around all this? Where are they on religion and the defense of science, for example, around the battle in relation to evolution? Where were they in Katrina in relation to what's going on in the inner cities, on the immigrants? Where in any of this are they taking a stand that represents interests fundamentally different than what the Republicans are bringing forward, and in particular represents the interests of the people in all this? So the question once again comes back to, after we see what stands they take and don't take, why do the Democrats take this position and have the overall stand that these positions embody and represent? And the essential reason, and it's important for not only for us to grasp this, but to be able to struggle substantively with people around this, the essential reason is not that they do this or somehow need to do it to get elected. Once again, this is viewing everything and accepting the terms, confines, and dynamics of bourgeois electoral politics. Electability becomes the criterion for everything. But that is not why the Democrats do what they do. It is sometimes why they say they do what they do. But it is not the actual reason why they do what they do. It goes back to, and the reasons are rooted in what I was discussing earlier, actual dynamics of the system, the whole point in relation to the pyramid of power analysis. This is why they take the stands they do and don't take the stands they don't. Once again, you can look at the great discrepancy or disconnect, to use their word, between the stance and positions of a Democratic Party as determined by its leadership and what the great majority of the rank-and-file Democratic Party adherents and those who end up voting for the Democrats actually think and what they want to see as the stance and positions of the Democrats. This is a very acute contradiction, and we should be not only pointing to it and hammering home that point of what an acute contradiction is, but going deeply into the reasons for why there is this contradiction and why it repeatedly poses itself very acutely, rooted in all the reasons that I've spoken to up to this point. And it's very important to bring home that this regime must be, it's not a matter of the of Bush at all being voted out, even assuming that would happen. But it's a matter and a question that it must be driven out through the actions of masses of people, through independent and historical political action on a truly massive scale. Because it's only if that happens that the terms of things can be changed in a way that holds the potential of something favorable for the people and in their interest to actually emerge out of this. And this is a crucial point to really grasp deeply and to struggle with people over. If you let things go on in the dynamics of the elections, whether or not the Democrats win back more seats in the Congress now and whether or not they run some candidate who wins in 2008, the dynamics and the framework of everything is going to be more and more unfavorable and more horrific. By that time, we may be at war with Iran, and think of everything that that implies. I'm not saying that that will definitely happen, but it is a definite possibility. And, one of the most chilling things is when you read that in the articles in our paper and other places where it quotes that, former official of the government running down all the terrible things that would happen if we attack Iran and then saying, but those aren't as bad as not attacking Iran if that's what's needed to not allow it to have nuclear weapons. And how does voting for the Democrats figure into that, let alone all the other things that I've mentioned? The point is, and we really have to drive this point home to people, the whole political calculus must be dramatically changed. And that is not going to happen through this electoral process and by staying within the confines that dominate the political scene now. The whole political calculus must be dramatically changed. The whole political terrain must be completely transformed. And that cannot and will not happen other than through independent and historical political action on a truly massive scale. The current dynamics and trajectory must be ruptured onto something radically different through this mass political action. And this is something we have to grasp deeply ourselves and struggle really effectively to win people to come to terms and grips with, because many people don't want to come to terms and grips with this, because it's frightening. And it challenges everything that they believe and want to believe, particularly more in the middle strata, but not only there, about the whole nature of this country and the whole character of how political decision-making goes on and all the implications if that's not the way political decision-making goes on, particularly in the context of all the heavy things that are already happening and are hanging heavily in the air. So we have to emphasize to people that we have to bring this. We, through mass political action, have to bring this to a halt. The wars, the lies, the torture, the spying and repression. That is why we have to focus and raise as the battle cry, the political battle cry, the world can't wait, drive out the Bush regime. Because we have to bring this to a halt. And no one else is going to do that. And no other dynamic is going to achieve that. And we need to discuss with people in a living and a substantive way why that's so and what that means. Now, stepping back further from our standpoint, while driving out the Bush regime is not identical to, and it's important for us to understand this, is not identical to revolution and will not necessarily and automatically or even likely lead to a revolutionary situation. And it's important to make those distinctions. On the other hand, from our strategic standpoint, and not that of everybody else in the United Front by definition, but from our strategic standpoint, this does have to do with hastening while awaiting in a major way toward revolution. And it is conceivable, not certain, perhaps not probable, but definitely conceivable that out of all the volatile mix that would be involved in actually driving out this regime, that things could approach closely to or even get to the threshold of the emergence of a revolutionary situation. We cannot guarantee that. That is not the objective in driving out the Bush regime per se. But from a stepping back from a larger, again, larger universal, larger strategic perspective, it's what we are working toward, and everyone we can win to that, is working toward in taking this up as it is with everything we take up, but there is a particular and concentrated importance to this. That this could contribute in a major and concentrated way to the sharpening of contradictions in a more favorable way rather than in a more unfavorable way. Now, with regard to both World Can't Wait and driving out the Bush regime and on a more fundamental level, repolarizing for revolution. But it must be said, with different dimensions and on different levels, the following are important elements. We have to grasp the dynamics, the interplay and mutual influence between, to put it that way, the bottom and the top of the pyramid. Between, in other words, the actions of masses of people, especially as they are mobilized in independent historical political action on a mass scale, and the actions of the two sides of the top of the pyramid. In other words, part of what happens in any dynamics that bring about a major change in society, and certainly this is true of a revolutionary change, but even major change short of that, part of the dynamics is that the contradictions in society find concentrated expression in the sharpening of contradiction and struggle within the ruling class. And that, in turn, provides more opening and basis for mass political struggle to develop and to reach higher proportions and dimensions. In this book on slavery that I referred to earlier, it was very interesting to see how many of the major slave revolts in the Caribbean and Brazil and other places took place in relationship to the belief, whether well-founded or mistaken, the belief on the part of the slaves that there were moves on the part of the political structure toward abolishing slavery. It's not, to be clear, that the slaves should sit around and wait till the slave masters or other sections of the ruling class start talking about ending slavery before they should rebel. But as dialectical materialists, as people with a scientific approach, we should understand this back and forth relationship between what goes on at the top of society and how the masses at the base of society perceive things in relation to that. Lenin talked about this in terms of speaking about how, as he put it, in ordinary times the masses uncomplainingly allow themselves to be robbed. But when the contradictions become more acute within the ranks of the ruling class, then this provides fissures and cracks through which the suppressed anger of the masses can burst forth more readily. It's the same kind of dynamic I'm talking about here. But here the emphasis is actually coming around from the other side. The more that mass, in the context of all these contradictions and their sharpening, the more that mass political resistance comes from below, that in turn is going to recast the terms in which even the ruling class has to respond and will have an influence on even the contradictions and struggle within the ruling class on both sides of the top of the pyramid, if you will, which in turn will have an influence back upon the base among the people, so to speak. Now, the point is not to get some gimmicky thing going where we have some do some things and that makes the politicians respond, you know, and then we can get more people to do. No. That would be reducing this to a reformist gimmick in the worst sense. But we should understand the actual dynamics as they're going to come into play in one form or another, and we should be able, by grasping and applying this correct outlook and method, to be able to wield this understanding to correctly move in relationship to this back and forth dynamic between the top and the bottom. It's going to happen in one form or another, negatively or positively. Right now, it's mainly negative. The fact that the contradictions at the top of the pyramid, so to speak, are staying within certain confines is having a certain definite paralyzing effect on the masses in the base. Once again, hastening while awaiting. We don't have a passive attitude toward that. We examine the contradictions. We look, you know, at the actual dynamics. We figure out the ways to break through in certain key ways on that. And we then look to the ways in which that is, without pitching ourselves to that or confining ourselves to that. We look for the ways in which that's reverberating, that's having an effect back at the top, and how we can move further in relationship to that. So this is one important point of orientation, understanding correctly and not reducing it to pin the masses on the tail of the donkey or of the ruling class in general. Now, another important strategic dimension, which I just want to touch on very briefly and in a general sense, which is, however, posing itself very acutely right now, is what we could call the whole border question. It's taking shape now very sharply around the question of immigration. But you can see in these events and in the sharpening of things around the question of immigration how real and how important the dynamic interplay is between the one country and the other in particular, between the U.S. and Mexico. This is, you know, in an underlying sense, in terms of the profound dynamics, this has been true all along and has been sharpening up objectively in terms of with NAFTA and other ways in which the Mexican economy has been affected. People have been further driven out of the countryside, unable to live there, driven partly into the cities in Mexico, but also more and more driven across the border. This has already been happening, but now it's assuming a conscious, more conscious expression or a more conscious battle, presently overwhelmingly on ruling class terms, within the superstructure, in politics, in the struggle over what to do about this. But while the terms are still essentially those of the ruling class, there is definitely a massive element from below, which is not yet in any essential way broken out of those confines, but which has the potential to do so with very big implications and repercussions there too. And even stepping back further to a broader universal level, we can see illustrated in this that from a very grand strategic standpoint, if you will, you can see illustrated how the very close mutual interconnection and mutual influence of these two societies and how that would be magnified in the context of any all-out revolutionary struggle in either or both countries. So that's another important strategic point of orientation to have clearly in mind, both in terms of relating to specific events or particulars like this immigration battle, which is temporarily, you know, died down in terms of the mass upsurge, but it still holds the potential for even greater upsurge. But also more broadly in that, in looking at even broader, grand strategic revolutionary terms. Now, I want to speak a little bit before moving to a conclusion to the question of, once more to the question of, could we really win? This is a big stumbling block for a lot of people. And, you know, the overwhelming answer, if you took a poll, would be no fucking way. You know, and that's not just for, like, superficial or incidental reasons. It has to do with the very real strength of the imperialists, some, you know, for reasons that I've touched on here and analyzed in certain aspects. But once again, it's important to stress, even in talking about this in a more limited way, that everything is contradiction. It is not monolithic, undivided, unchallengeable power. Everything is contradiction. So that's a crucial as a point not only of general orientation, but of methodology as well, in terms of approaching every question, including this fundamental question of could there be circumstances under which the masses of people could really win a revolutionary struggle. Now, in response to the reasons why the overwhelming answer spontaneously is no fucking way, in other words, in response to the evident great strength of U.S. imperialism, in the world there are basically two erroneous mirror opposite, if you will, poles, which ultimately are part of and lead to the same thing. One of them is a phenomenon which is obvious around the world today, which is the phenomenon of terrorism. Basically, along with the overall ideological, political, and programmatic stance of these forces, there's also sort of a calculation that U.S. imperialism is too strong to be confronted frontally. And therefore, you have to find ways to hit it where it is weaker and not try to hit it where it is stronger in terms of its the concentration of its massive power. But this is actually ultimately, besides the other problems associated with this, is ultimately a form of capitulation to the strength of imperialism. And it inevitably or almost inevitably involves attacks other than on U.S. imperialism itself, attacks on civilians, you know, attacks on or lack of concern about the effects of action upon civilians. And this becomes part of a whole package which is wrong-headed and, you know, wrongly founded to begin with and reinforces that. So it takes a certain reality that the U.S. has great strength, but on that basis or proceeding from that, acts in a way which ultimately cannot lead to defeating imperialism and cannot point in the direction of any favorable result. So it's wrong not just in tactics, not just, for example, in the killing of civilians and increasingly the targeting of civilians, but is also wrong on a more strategic level in terms of what changes it's aiming to bring about in any case and ideologically in terms of worldview and what it's aiming for. And how it sees in that context friends and enemies. So, among other things, it's a very wrong, attempt at a solution. Wrong in many dimensions to the very real contradiction of technological disproportionality, if you will, or in the terminology of the imperialist military, the asymmetrical nature of the technological component of the contending sides. It is on every dimension a wrong, and worse than wrong, ultimately a reactionary response to that real phenomenon, and it is bound up with a whole ideological and political viewpoint and program which aims for things which are not a positive, not fundamentally an alternative to, and insofar as they are, you know, an alternative to imperialism, are not a positive one. They are not a fundamental alternative, and insofar as they represent any kind of alternative, it is not a positive one. So this is an expression, terrorism is an expression overall of an incorrect outlook and methodology serving a program and interests other than a thoroughgoing revolution leading to the abolition of all exploitation and oppression and ultimately the emancipation of all of humanity. It doesn't aim for that, and it's not capable of achieving it. And both things are important. And that is why increasingly, as I said, it ends up targeting not the actual source of oppression of the people, but even sections of the people themselves, and it aims for something which would not lead to the emancipation of all of humanity. And the two are bound together for the same reasons that the military approach, if you will, is wrong-headed. It is also part of an overall ideological viewpoint and program that is not, in the final analysis, emancipatory and cannot be emancipatory. There is too much, even if this were applied by people with a different outlook than, say, religious fundamentalism, there becomes, in the application of this approach, too much of a fundamental divide and contradiction between professed aims and actual means. And it's important to distinguish terrorism from a genuine people's war, where that is possible and the appropriate strategy. This is an important point to stress, because the imperialists deliberately set out to obliterate that distinction and to declare every kind of armed struggle against them, even one that has massive popular support and participation, to be a form of terrorism. And that's particularly true in these days. So it's very important to actually draw the objective distinction, to recognize and to emphasize the objective distinction, and to combat the attempts of the imperialists to obliterate that distinction and to equate any kind of revolutionary struggle, even that with massive popular support and involvement, as being an act of, or a form of terrorism. Now, the opposite, mirror opposite of this is reformism, and particularly in the expression of giving up altogether on being able to win the struggle for power. It shares with terrorism the basic assessment that, to put it in simple terms, they're too powerful. And it amounts to openly settling for living under this system, with at most some reforms, which, for all the reasons I've been discussing, falls and can only fall woefully short of meeting the most fundamental needs of the mass of people and dealing with the real problem and the real solution. Now, there, in the history of our movement, there have been these kind of tendencies. For example, toward the end of his life, Engels fell into the view that an armed insurrection could only happen under very rare circumstances and really only at the very end of a process of, you know, a political process which involved extensive working through the system, so to speak. Some of the tendencies of the German Social Democratic Party under Kautsky, which Lenin polemicized against so sharply, were actually shared to some degree by Engels. It doesn't negate the important contributions in many dimensions that Engels made to the whole communist cause, but it is a fact that he increasingly came to view the struggle for revolution, particularly in Germany, or the struggle for socialism, particularly in Germany, more and more in terms of building up parliamentary strength, strengthen the trade unions, and then perhaps at the very end of that whole process, under certain very rare circumstances, given the military strength of the bourgeoisie, it might be possible to go up against them. And this does lead in the direction of giving up on the struggle for the seizure of power. It's not that it's wrong to understand, in fact, it's very necessary to understand, that an actual struggle for power can only occur in conditions where the bourgeoisie is politically weakened and where the contradictions within its ranks, as well as in society more broadly and in the larger world context, have become extremely acute. But to see this, the point I'm trying to get at, is to see this in sort of a gradualist way, and leads in the direction rather than of revolution, leads rather toward reformism. And again, it's not harder to understand why people have tended in these directions and veered in these directions, when they have confronted, as you must confront, the actual strength of the bourgeois state, and this is all the more so and in a magnified way when you're talking about the U.S. imperialist state. But nonetheless, if you come to grips with the understanding that only revolution can provide the way to out of this whole madness, that the essential and defining and driving and fundamental contradictions can only be resolved through the revolutionary seizure of power, then while correctly understanding that this has to be based upon and be the initiative of masses of people, you cannot fall into an orientation of gradualism in a strategic sense, of evolution instead of revolution. You cannot make revolution in the absence of a revolutionary situation or with a handful acting with or without such a situation. That's a crucial principle to grasp, and to grasp firmly. But on the other hand, if your orientation is one of working to sort of gradually build toward some far-off time when magically the ruling class would be weakened or paralyzed enough, then you're going to lose the basic orientation of hastening while awaiting for revolution. And there is an crucial distinction between hastening while awaiting for revolution and recognizing the necessity of the objective conditions to ripen in a qualitative way, and for it to be possible, therefore, to bring forward masses in their millions onto the stage to wage this struggle, on the one hand, versus falling into evolutionism, on the other hand, which in effect writes out the struggle for the seizure of power altogether. That's an important, in fact, fundamental dividing line and crucial distinction to make. And it's very easy to fall into this form of gradualism and evolutionism, particularly when one stares in the face the actual strength of the ruling class that you're up against. And or one can understand how people get drawn into attempts at going up against the system in a way that's isolated from the masses, does not have their support, and ends up, in fact, turning against the masses in various ways and actually weakening the masses in their ability to be brought forward as a revolutionary force to finally, when the conditions emerge, wage the revolutionary struggle for power. So here I just want to touch very briefly on certain key elements of the correct synthesis and approach. One key principle involved here is to grasp correctly the interrelation of the political and the military spheres. This specifically in relation to the waging of a truly mass revolutionary struggle for power involving millions and enjoying the support of tens of millions more. Now, what I mean by this interrelation has various dimensions and it takes expression in different ways. There is a certain interplay of these factors all along, although that takes different form than it does at the time when a revolutionary situation does emerge. And all along, without overstepping things at any given time, and without getting off onto the wrong road and attempting things prematurely and inappropriately, it is necessary to be working consciously with strategic goals in mind, with a correct strategic orientation, so that even the development of political movements and political influence and organized ties, when there is not yet a revolutionary situation, among all strata of the people and stretching in every part of society, is geared strategically toward the situation when the conditions for revolution will have emerged. Again, let me emphasize that it's crucial to do this without overstepping things and acting as if you're in one kind of situation when you're not yet in that situation, which will lead to disaster. If there's to be a revolution, a fundamental element of that is there has to be a revolutionary people in masses. Not in a few hundred or even a few thousand, but in the millions. And a revolutionary orientation, a strategic revolutionary orientation, is grounded in that and leads toward working toward that objective. Because that's the basis without which there can be no revolutionary struggle for the seizure of power. And any attempt, whatever the road is, any attempt to wage a struggle for power or to confront the other side in those terms without a revolutionary people in masses, in millions, is bound to lead to defeat and to severe setbacks, not only practically, but politically and ideologically, leading to demoralization of the masses, to their being smashed organizationally and politically, and their being disoriented and demoralized for a long period of time. So that's a bedrock principle. If there is to be a revolution, there must be a revolutionary people. And that is dialectically related to the developments toward and then the emergence of a revolutionary situation, because you will not get a revolutionary people in the millions except in dialectical relation with the development of a revolutionary situation and its full ripening. But you have to be working toward that all along the way without overstepping, without getting onto the wrong road, and without acting in ways that are only appropriate when there is a revolutionary people and a revolutionary situation. So in this period, all during the period, between now and the emergence of that revolutionary situation, and while hastening, and in the context of hastening while awaiting, there is what has been referred to as the two tracks that need to be carried out, or work on two tracks. One is the development of the necessary theory and doctrine and strategic orientation that would be necessary to wage the struggle for power when there is the emergence of a revolutionary people and a revolutionary situation, and to be clear, not before. And this needs to take into account not only general and fundamental principles of strategy, but also particularities of the situation and of the specific country in question, including the class and social configuration or anatomy in that particular country. And in this way, it has to encompass and provide the basis for combining all positive factors in that arena when that is what struggle comes on the agenda. It would be necessary in those conditions, in a different form, to combine all positive factors while minimizing to the greatest degree possible all negative factors, and have the correct orientation and strategic means for turning negative into positive factors during the course of the struggle for power when that has come on the agenda. And then in a more concentrated way, with the emergence of a revolutionary and ripening of a revolutionary situation, with as a crucial component of that the emergence onto the scene of a revolutionary people, and then with the actual outbreak of the struggle for the all-out struggle for power, there will be a very close and intense back and forth between the political and the military spheres at that time. Political factors will significantly influence the all-out struggle for power, and that struggle in turn will influence the political situation. And being able to, at that time, in that qualitatively different situation, correctly handle that dynamic will have a great bearing on whether you're able to actually do what needs to be done to have a chance of winning, including in terms of disintegrating the forces of the other side when you get to that point. Because while that cannot be, everything cannot be hinged on that, being able at that time and under those conditions to disintegrate the forces of the other side will be an important and in some ways crucial element of having a chance of winning the all-out struggle for power. Now, one of the key things that's been touched on in discussing this whole question is the relationship between a legitimacy crisis and a revolutionary crisis. This has to do with the working on the two tracks. The one track, the development of doctrine and strategy and theory. The other track, all of the all-around work that goes into building up the resistance and the mass political struggle and helps to bring into being, together with changes in the objective condition, a revolutionary people of millions. So you have these two tracks that are going on simultaneously, and then with the emergence of a revolutionary situation and a revolutionary people, they're brought together at that point and not before. And into this context, the question of legitimacy crisis and its relationship with revolutionary crisis is extremely important. The key element of any state power in a certain sense, or a concentrated expression of it in any case, is its monopoly of violence, and in particular of legitimate violence. And on the other hand, in terms of the development of a revolutionary situation, the loss of that monopoly, at least of legitimate violence, in the eyes of broad sections of the people in society. When, for example, in Iran in 1978, when the people would mobilize against the Shah, and I remember talking to Iranian students in the U.S. at that time, and they told the story of how on one day, as things were reaching the acute concentration point, 10,000 people were shot down by the Shah's troops in one day. And in the next day, there was an even more massive outpouring. That is a clear sign of things reaching the approach of and the threshold of a revolutionary situation. And in the eyes of the masses, the monopoly of legitimate violence on the part of the Shah and what he represented in terms of the ruling structures of the country was significantly and qualitatively lost. Now, you can't get metaphysical about this. It doesn't mean there wasn't anybody left who supported the Shah. But masses of people rejected the notion that the Shah was using legitimate violence. In a different way than people might have hated the Savak, the secret police who tortured people, or hated the Shah's armed forces who periodically repressed outpourings of resistance. People may have hated that. It may have been, you know, bitterly resented it. But that's different than coming to the conclusion in an all-around sense that this is illegitimate violence, that this state power embodies illegitimate violence. Violence for illegitimate ends by illegitimate means. And the loss of that sense of legitimacy, particularly in terms of the monopoly of violence, among truly massive numbers of people in society, is one of the key elements not only of a legitimacy crisis, but of a revolutionary crisis, particularly if work is and has been all along done by revolutionary forces working on that one track toward bringing onto the stage a revolutionary people of millions when the objective conditions ripen for that. Now, here is an interesting quote in the book Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, America, the Cold War, and the Roots of Terror by Mahmoud Mamdani. He says, the modern sensibility is not horrified by pervasive violence. The world wars are proof enough of this. What horrifies our modern sensibility is violence that appears senseless, that cannot be justified by progress. Now, without going to this further here, I think it's worthwhile posing the question. It's worthwhile reflecting on that statement and posing the question. What does that have to do with this question of legitimacy, monopoly of legitimized violence, and with the loss of that legitimacy, the loss of that monopoly of legitimate violence? What does it have to do with that? And in turn, what does it have to do with the question of reactionary violence on the one hand and revolutionary violence of masses of a revolutionary people on the other hand? So without going into that further here, I just pose that as something worth thinking and reflecting on and wrangling with. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Sir No Sir, but one of the things it brings out very powerfully is how, under a certain set of contradictions, both international and within the U.S. itself, the allegiance of a significant section of the ground forces of the army of U.S. imperialism was seriously weakened and fragmented and even fractured. And how increasingly they had to rely upon what is the fundamental base of their military power anyway, killing at a safe distance from the air and by other means. And this is an historical lesson which, without going into it further here, is also worth pondering. What does that have to do with the questions that have been touched on here about the emergence of a revolutionary people, particularly in the context of a revolutionary situation? What does it have to do with the two tracks and the bringing together of those two tracks at the time when a revolutionary situation has emerged and ripened? What does it have to do with the possibility of actually winning the struggle for the seizure of power when masses are prepared and determined in their millions to fight for that? Now, there have been changes since that time of Vietnam. They got rid of the draft and put in an all-volunteer army. And you've noticed that the core of the ruling class now, as represented by Rumsfeld and Bush and others, have very strongly resisted any move toward reinstituting a draft, because they understand some of this history as well and some of the implications of what it would mean to reinstitute a draft and how that would affect, the whole thing of the NPR woman going shopping. That kind of outlook would be qualitatively affected if a draft were instituted. Let's put it that way. But again, imperialists do not have all freedom and no necessity. They've already had to do several tours, enforced tours of duty, of not only regular troops but National Guard troops who thought they were going to be having weekends hanging out with other, male bonding and whatever, And instead, are going through what they're going through in Iraq. And whether or not they're able to hold off reinstituting the draft is not entirely up to them and their subjective wishes. And if you look at their grand ambitions in the context of what that will unleash, this whole equation around the draft and all of the larger implications of that could change radically and dramatically too. So all of this brings me then to the conclusion of this talk. From all I've said, it should be clear what our goal is and must be: to strike at the real problem and bring forward the real solution. To bring forward and lead a revolution of masses in their millions and tens of millions, aiming at establishing a whole new and radically different kind of state power, and aiming beyond that for a whole new and radically different and much better world, to achieve the four alls and move forward to communism all over the globe, to achieve the emancipation of humanity and a whole different future for humanity. To invoke again the lines from Bob Dylan, "The hour is getting late, so let us not talk falsely now." What we are talking about will involve wrenching struggle on a massive scale and require sacrifice on a whole other level from anything experienced up till now. but it will be emancipating beyond anything achieved or even fully conceived up until now in the history of humanity, looking at it with historical perspective. Once again, very acutely, the question of a horrible end or an end to the horror is posed in a very concentrated way. And the question of bringing forward the emancipators of humanity through all this wrenching process and sacrifice poses the challenge that's before us, and the challenge that we have to be willing to, and we have to become, in a very telescoped way, able to rise to.